Accession number 4627, reel number 5.
Army Film Unit, Roy Bolting, reel 5.
Good God. Contemptible.
You mentioned a moment ago covering GIs in action. That indicates that you must have been a roving cameraman, roving between both British and American forces, and therefore unique as far as the British Army Film Unit was concerned. Is this the true impression?
I was quite independent of the Army Film Unit as such, because I had this special commission to provide material that I thought and hoped would be useful in the making of the true Roy, I mean the Carol Reed, Garth and Kanin film about the Second Front. So, I mean, my mandate was very wide. I mean, I could go with the French, as I did, with the Americans, and with the British.
With the Canadians, too?
And with the Canadians. My goodness, yes. Outside Cannes, I was with the Canadians for quite a while. But, I had a very unique and very special, and by goodness, after my experience of Desert Victory and Africa Freed and Tunisian Victory, and then the rejection of the script that Irwin Shaw and Frank Harvey, Captain Frank Harvey, and myself had produced for a film that would eventually be the Second Front film, I was really most relieved to get away from what had become just too much of a good thing. There were too many people involved in the making of a film. I mean, I have already said and told you about the numbers who were involved. And I wanted to feel that I was part of something in which I could produce perhaps take a look at the war in ways perhaps that the Army Film Unit cameramen would not be concerned. I mean, for example, at a place called Courville, I arrived in it at the time the Germans had just pulled out, and they had taken all of the women who had associated with the Germans, and they were there in the square. Don't forget, this was summer, a very, very hot summer, and all these poor women, prostitutes, collaborators, or collaboratists, or I didn't know, but here they were, paraded. And I felt ashamed for the people who were parading them, by the way. But there they were, and they were being publicly shaved. Their hair was being cut off and removed to mark them as people who had, in fact, collaborated, had been with, had lived with, had loved, had whatever, with the Germans. But, I mean, that was my opportunity. And those are the kind of things, the human, the terrifying, perhaps, if you like, human revelations that I was able to shoot and send back, that perhaps the ordinary Army Film Unit cameraman, who was doing a much tougher job than I was, it wouldn't occur to him to do. Indeed, he wasn't briefed to do it. He was there to work with the frontline troops.
Would it be fair to say that yours was more the filming of civilian life, the return to
normality? I didn't think so. I mean, I just took material as and when I thought it was going to be of use. So I was involved in battles.
Did the directors of your film ask for specific sequences ever from you?
No, never. I mean, how could they? I mean, you can't ask for specifics in the middle of a battle when you're back in London assembling material. I understood that fully. I knew that because I had been in their position. I knew, how difficult it was for them. But also, what I knew was that they would be requiring human things as distinct just from guns popping off, and the ordinary routine of war. And this was going to make, I mean, as far as I could contribute, this was going to make The True Glory that much more interesting as a film. My contribution, I think, was very, very small, but anyhow, in the shooting of it, of my material, I felt that I knew something about the kinds of things that they would be looking for and needing.
One can detect in the progression of campaign films, Desert Victory, Tunisian Victory, The True Glory, Burma Victory, a trend towards what one could call a democratization of the film, given that Burma Victory ends up in the form or includes the personal narrative of a private, and The True Glory does as well, an American and British. Were you aware at the time that you were filming in France and Germany that this was the shape of the film that Garson came and Carol Reed?
No, I really had I had no idea of what they would do. But, I mean, I've just talked about those unhappy women who had their heads shaved by those patriots in Courville in France. But then, let me say that when I arrived in Holland and I got to Eindhoven, and there's a great concert hall used by Philips, you know, who are really basically a Dutch firm. And a few days after I had arrived in there, Sir John Barbarolli and the Halle Orchestra arrived there and they said, we'll give a concert. And I must tell you that to see these members, it was freezing cold. Of course, there was no fuel. There was no heating. But to see these men, these wonderful musicians, sitting there in balaclava helmets, woolen hats, and woolen jackets, trying to keep warm in order to play their instruments, with this great man, for me, one of the great conductors of all time. And to record this, and this is where I think Hanford came in, because I managed to make contact with Hanford, and Hanford came, Peter Hanford, who I regard as one of the best of our, well, if not the best of all our sound men. Hanford said, yes, I'll come and do it. I didn't know how he extracted himself from the Army film unit. Anyhow, he came up, and he did. And he recorded the concert for me, and it's on film, and it's on tape. It's on sound film, in fact. That to me, and to see the response of the men in the forces who were able to attend the concert that Barbarolli gave. I mean, that for me was a reminder that this inhuman process of war can be ameliorated, can be changed around, that the people who participate and who play this awful and tragic role that they have to, of killing other people, if they can, that they are reminded of their humanity. So this I felt to be something that should be done and was worth doing.
Did your experience with Desert Victory, which was primarily a military film, influence your choice of material for The True Glory?
No. I mean, what I felt, I mean, having made Desert Victory, having then made Africa Freed and Tunisian Victory in collaboration with Frank Capra and John Huston and Anthony Bailey, I mean, using material that really had come just from the battle photographers, I knew, I understood, I think, just how important the human, I mean, just to be able to put a few feet in that reminded people that soldiers were also human beings, felt like human beings, loved like human beings. They were interested in apart from the birds, apart from the fun of the birds, but they also loved the things that all of us love. That is, music, painting. Well, I mean, there's a whole catalogue I don't need to go into. Do you understand?
So you reached Belsen and then shortly afterwards returned to Britain.
I was summoned back to Britain because Mountbatten, the Supreme Commander of Southeast Asia Command, wanted to film about the 14th Army. And he termed it, in his own vivid phrases that he employed, but in this particular phrase, he described it as the Forgotten Army. Well, quite true, it was a forgotten army. And David MacDonald, Colonel MacDonald then, was I think in charge of the unit out in Burma, and he had been given the task of making a film that would bring to the attention of the public in England, in Britain, the world, exactly what the 14th Army was achieving and what it was enduring, much more important. And MacDonald then had permission to recall me from Europe. I returned, and then once again at Pinewood, at Pinewood Studios, I started to look at all the material that had been shot. And out of all that material, out of the eventual achievements of the 14th Army, and with the assistance of Admiral Earl Mumbetan, who came and I was allowed to direct him. He's a really hard man to direct, by the way. But I was allowed to direct him, and he gave certain speeches that we used in the film. And I found him the most entertaining and slightly arrogant man, but certainly a brilliant man. Great personality, terrific personality.
Did you suffer from any interference in the making of the Victory?
Nope, not at all. Nope, Mumbetan really was the deciding factor, and he saw the film when it was finished. He liked it, he enjoyed it, and he thought it was a suitable memorial to those men who, in fact, as he put it, in his own words, which I thought were superb, he said, they gave their todays for our tomorrows. And nothing could have been, I think, expressed more succinctly and more suitably.
How did you manage to achieve the remarkably realistic portrayal of fighting in Burma without yourself ever having been there? For instance, the opening sequence and the monsoon and the sounds of the Japanese in the jungle.
I mean, then you simply have to give the credit, you know, 95% of the credit to the men who were there all that time and who shot the material.
But a fair amount of that material is studio material.
No. Well, there was a certain amount. I mean, you're now testing me because I find it really hard to remember exactly how much we shot. I know that we shot far, far less for Burma Victory than we shot for, example, Desert Victory. I mean, most of the material was, I think, actuality material, and it's the cameramen who shot it who deserve the credit. And if it worked, it is largely because, as John Grierson of the documentary newsletter, which I've just been reminded about since we last met, says the documentary is the creative interpretation of reality. Is that right? And, you see, I had completely forgotten, and now I understand why you asked me about the documentary newsletter, because I found today a letter that I had written to them. And this may have prompted your question.
This was the letter which was published.
I don't know whether it was published or not, but I mean, I was in the army then anyhow, but I mean, I know that I wrote it.
One of your letters
I discovered it today. I mean, covered in dust.
From Burma Victory, can we return to Africa Freed and Tunisian Victory?
Well, Africa Freed was one of my great frustrations. I'd made Desert Victory, and then, of course, the landings had taken place in North Africa. We knew there was a battle on. Hugh Stewart, Major Stewart, was in charge of the unit out there. The material was coming back. And there we were, with the British, the American, and the French, all fighting on the same side against the common enemy. And at a certain point, and James Lansdale Hodgson, who unhappily now is dead, but who was great supporter, great help, great journalist, good writer. And I said to him one day, I said, James, isn't it ridiculous? Here we are making a film about what is essentially an Allied operation. And he said, anyway, he was Lancashire and had spoke with a very deep voice, but Roy said, you're quite right. Said, we shouldn't be making a film. So I then spoke to my commanding officer, who spoke to my general, who spoke to the MFI, who spoke to I don't know who. But Desert Victory had in fact filled them with enormous, enormous enthusiasm for the power of the film. And although we were living, fighting and dying side by side, in fact, there was no great belief that we should be making one film. However, whatever arguments were offered, and I mean they were offered by me, but through Hodgson, who was an independent force and was not in the services, but was a writer, and who was giving his services for free, eventually they were persuaded that there was some kind of merit in the idea that we should be making a film together. And then came the word from Washington that Colonel Frank Capra was already shooting scenes, I think it was Texas. It was somebody flat area. He was shooting scenes reproducing the Battle of Kasserine Pass in America. And that in the circumstances, it wouldn't be sensible. So then, having been told this, then I pulled all the stops out. Hodgson and I, in fact, made the film. Africa Freed, we called it. And we made it perfectly certain that people understood this is the British participation in the operation. It isn't a total. It isn't American or French. It's just the British. And we finished it. We showed it. The Ministry of Information, I think, loved it. A copy was sent to Washington. And the following day, Washington cabled, I don't know whether it was, in fact, the Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, or whether it was, in fact, the Ministry of Information, that is the Minister, Brendan Bracken, saying, from George Marshall, who was their top military man, said, please don't put this film out until we have had a chance to get together. I am getting Colonel Capra, Captain Houston, Captain Anthony Veillet they'll be flying across tomorrow. And so having made the film, we scrapped the film. It was never shown. And then we made a film called Tunisian Victory, which, like all films of that kind, where clearly the objectives are quite distinct and different, opposed perhaps even. We made a film that it did a job. It certainly didn't satisfy me. It made me enormously unhappy. In fact, I had to fight Edith Hudson to express what the various contributions were. And one is that there were 35,000 British soldiers killed and wounded. There were 12,500 French killed and wounded. And there were something like 5,000, I could be wrong, it could have been 6, but there was something like that. But I had to fight to get that in the picture, because what Colonel Capra, I mean, he was doing a job for his country. I understood, except that I thought it was a very short-sighted view. But what he wanted to suggest was that the battle had been won by the American forces. In fact, the American forces, and gosh, I mean, why not? They were green. They had every right to fail. They had every right to make a mess of it, which they did at the beginning of the North African campaign. They made a mess of it, and the people like Patton came through to in fact impose upon them an enormous discipline. And because the Americans have enormous vitality and great courage and great vigor, they learned their lessons. But it would have been untrue to have made the film Tunisian Victory without expressing it in the truth of the terms of lives laid down and the fight was made. Because after all, between the English First Army, led by what Montgomery once said to me, I asked him, what do you think of Major, what do you think of General Anderson? He said, he's a first class, he's a first class second cook. And between Anderson's force and the 8th Army driving up along the coast, the French and the Americans, I mean, the Germans really had it. But the contribution was predominantly British at that time, and of necessity. And no one, I mean, no one can either reproach or condemn. But, I mean, what I felt very strongly about was the idea of suggesting that the Americans had, in fact, done the whole job themselves.
Well, moving away from this question of the portrayal of who actually had contributed most to victory, the style of Tunisian Victory is very, very different to the style of Africa Freed. For example, it's very sentimental, whereas Africa Freed is realistic. It's much faster. There's much greater use of fake material.
Yes, I thought that Africa Freed was... I didn't like it very much at all. I mean, it was rushed through in order to, in fact, preempt our having a film shown that suggested that we had played no part in the war in North Africa.
Why did you not like it?
I didn't like it. It wasn't sufficiently, for me, a departure from the techniques of Desert Victory. I'd done that. I wanted you to do something else. And so I didn't think it enough. But when I met Tony Veyhe, who had written the script for the Tunisian victory film, and I read at the end his words. This is a story written in blood upon a sea of sand. I said, oh my God, I mean, we can't have that. I mean, that is the last thing that we can accept. No. So it was the most unhappy film in many ways. I mean, as much as I admire Capra, I have a reverence for it.